Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. I'm glad you've tuned in today, and I'm very happy to welcome back to the program today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, Terry Curtis. And we're going to be talking today about animal behavior, problems that animals or pets may have that might be inconvenient to us and might indicate some distress on the part of the animal. Today's episode is pre-recorded. We won't be able to take your calls today, but I hope you'll find our discussion informative and entertaining even. And I want to welcome you back today. Thank you for being here. Grateful for you to come by.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you deal every day with folks who've gotten in touch and said, hey, you know, our pet is exhibiting some behavior that we find maybe inappropriate or unhelpful or inconvenient in some way, right?
Absolutely.
And this is something that many pet owners complain about, behavior issues?
They do. And I think the important thing to kind of put forth in the beginning here is an acknowledgement that people are always working from the best place and the best intentions, rescuing dogs and cats from shelters and places like that, and want only the best thing for these pets. And I find that the vast majority, if not all of my clients, find themselves in a place where they didn't sign on for the pet that they currently have, the dog that is aggressive to people or not getting along with the other dog in the household, the cat that's urinating or spraying all over the house, dogs that are flying through plate glass windows because they're afraid during a storm or they're panicked when their owners leave. So this really can be a dire place for the owner who just wanted to do the right thing by adopting or rescuing a pet and now find themselves in a really difficult situation.
I appreciate that you make that statement because those of us who have adopted pets before, I think you're exactly right. We go to the shelter and we look at the animals and we have pretty limited information to go on. We see the animal there and maybe we think the animal is cute or it looks happy, and we spend, you know, I don't know, a pretty short amount of time with the animal. If we're wise, if we're able to, we might make a couple visits and sort of analyze the animal a little bit more. But most likely, people spend what? I mean, in your estimation, just, I don't know, an hour or so with an animal before adopting it?
If that. And it would be like if someone picked you out of a jail cell. And so they come and they visit you and, you know, how you act in that confined area in a strange place with a lot of noises and different occupants nearby. That's not who you really are. And so you're not going to find out what that pet is all about until he's home in your house and you find out what's really going on. But the other thing to remember is, and I'm all for rescue of all kinds, but a lot of our pets that we're rescuing come with a rap sheet. And so they've been in that rescue for a reason. And so they could all already come to you with a history of aggression to people or other dogs or a history of separation anxiety. And that's why they're there in the first place. And you may not know that. And again, it's all the best of intentions. And just trying to figure out a way to keep these pets in the house that they find themselves and the family that they're now a part of.
So let me not in any way, shape, or form try and disparage the good work that folks in shelter medicine do and folks who work hard to get animals into stable, permanent homes. Of course, that's a labor of love for many people, and they do excellent work. But it sounds like, and I'm sure that many folks' stories can kind of bear this out, that the animal that you adopt might have been turned over to the shelter for some kind of behavioral issue.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And again, I'm not disparaging them either. I think we find ourselves in a place in a culture where shelters are a very important part of where our animals need to be or at least temporarily and where we get many of our animals from. So it's always going to be a balancing act trying to figure out just how to make everybody happy. And that's what I do.
One of my guests on a previous episode of Animal Airwaves Live, and this has been many years ago, was a human psychologist who had done some work with a graduate student of his. And part of what they had kind of worked out was that, in fact, folks who adopt an animal might have spent very little time in the shelter and particularly with dogs, were cued into a few certain behaviors that made it more likely that that particular animal would be adopted. And the behaviors that they were looking for, that humans were looking for, that is to say, to adopt a dog, would be like a kind of a friendly-seeming disposition, right? An animal that was attentive but not overly needy, certainly not an animal that was like, you know, it seemed calm enough, but not withdrawn, right? Mm-hmm. And certainly not an animal that was aggressive. But as you pointed out, a shelter is not a really great place to analyze the actual behavior of an animal. What is it that we might do, those of us who are interested in adopting an animal, to be better decision makers when it comes to going to a shelter and adopting an animal?
I would get one of those magic eight balls, you know, and you turn it over and whatever it says, that's about as good as your assessment's going to be. There's just no guarantee. It's going to come down to how the person feels about the connection that they have with that particular pet, whether they get it because it is gregarious and friendly, or, oh, I'm going to pick the one that's in the corner that's not looking at me because it's the one that needs a home. The bottom line is it's all subject to change once it gets into the person's household with the person's routine. If there's other pets in the household, how that the new pet is going to react to the pets that are already in the household. So it's all going to be it's going to be a crapshoot, and so you just go with your best instincts. And again, what I do is not so much dwell on the whys that the behavior problems exist. It's okay, you've got a problem. What are we going to do about it? It's problem solving.
Would you say that in your experience, younger pets or older pets tend to have more problems for folks when adopting an animal?
When it comes to dogs especially, there's a time of social maturity that hits at about a year, year and a half, and extends to about 3 years. And so you can see some behavioral changes that occur in that time frame. So people that get dogs as puppies often think that they have puppy with X personality, and they find that when they go through social maturity, that can totally change. It's basically like teenage years in humans. And so my recommendation to someone who is getting a rescue would be to get a dog that's 3 years or older, because at least you kind of know what you have at that point.
Yeah.
What that individual is at three or four is pretty much what it's going to be. Doesn't mean it doesn't have any problems in it, that it can't get problems, but it's a more known entity.
That's a fascinating observation, because I have wondered myself, you know, whether or not adopting an animal as a puppy or kitten might give the human being an opportunity to shape that animal's personality, or adopting an adult mature animal might give you a little bit better insight into that animal's current personality and allow you to make a choice that maybe fits your personality a little bit better.
I think so. And I think with puppies, and especially I see this with a lot of my own clients, where the fact that the matter is that puppies haven't changed. And often I get clients who have just recently had an older dog pass, maybe 12, 13 years old. So their last experience with a dog was with a 13-year-old geriatric dog. And now they get a puppy that's 8 weeks or 12 weeks old. Puppies haven't changed, but those people are now 13 years older. Their expectation of what a dog does and what a dog is like is that of a 13-year-old geriatric dog. And now there's a puppy in their household, and they're just not prepared for that. And so a lot of what we consider to be problems are just normal puppy behavior. So it's making the decision with eyes wide open and mind wide open, realizing that at the end of the day, these are dogs and cats that we're adopting and asking to be part of our human household.
So this is another fantastic observation. So let's kind of break down some of the behaviors associated with, say, puppies that folks who maybe haven't had a puppy in a long time might have forgotten about, that might be things to consider so that you're not feeling like, oh my gosh, this dog is defective in some way.
Well, I think the two that pop into my mind first would be house training. When you're used to having a dog that knows when to go and where to go, all of a sudden you have a puppy that has no idea. And so puppies need to eliminate every few hours, if not more than that, when they're puppies. So again, your whole routine has to now accommodate this new little critter. The other thing is chewing, is how destructive they can be when they're puppies, because everything is processed with their mouth. So it's kind of getting down literally or figuratively on your knees, taking a look at the house and what does this look like from the puppy's perspective? And maybe having to puppy-proof things that you haven't had to even think about in years.
This sounds not terribly dissimilar to child-proofing a home when
Absolutely.
You finally have a toddler who can kind of get up and around on her own, and you find that she has discovered every dangerous thing that you weren't even aware was in the room. Puppy is probably about the same.
Exactly. And they're just looking for something to play with. It's not, you know, they're not out to ruin your day. They're just looking for fun.
Yeah. Now, kittens are certainly very active, do a lot of zany stuff, but also are not necessarily mature adult cats, certainly not what they are necessarily going to be like when they're older. Certainly if you know, every 12-year-old cat was the same as a kitten, I don't know how we would all survive. But kittens, very boisterous, get into things as well.
Yep, and I think that probably the take-home message there would be is to understand how rambunctious they are as kittens. And a thing to kind of keep in your mind as someone who's going to adopt a kitten would be to think about getting two. Littermates or kittens that are about the same age now have each other to kind of get all of that normal, which can be very rough, play out in a legal way. So they're kind of fighting with each other and playing with each other instead of either looking at an older cat as the potential play victim or looking at a person. Play aggression can be pretty severe, but the motivation is play. So providing that kitten with a legal playmate can do a lot to diffuse or totally redirect that behavior.
That's wonderful advice. And, of course, folks might be able to do something that I know in the past I have wanted to do, which is keep two pets from the same litter together.
Yep. And ideally, if the situation presents itself and the mom is there, then grab the mom, too, because kittens learn a lot from their mother. And they're going to learn boundaries. They're going to learn when to bite, when not to bite, when to scratch, when not to scratch. So if there's a mom and two siblings at the rescue organization or in your vet's office, grab them all.
We are just scratching the surface here on this episode of Animal Airwaves Live. I'm Dana Hill. My guest is Terry Curtis. From the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, we're talking about animal behavior, and we will be right back after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live on WUFT-FM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and today my guest from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine is Terry Curtis. We are not taking any calls today. This is a recorded episode, but I am really grateful to those of you who emailed your questions in, and I'm going to be presenting some of those to Dr. Curtis a little bit later in the show. Meanwhile, I hope you'll find this episode informative, and I hope it will be entertaining to some of you as well. So when you are working with clients who have pets, you hit on earlier some of the issues that come up a lot, and it might be a good time to get into what some of those would be. And this can probably be an issue at a young age or an old age, and one of those might be inappropriate elimination, right? Now, this could be urination or defecation or something like that. And this can probably happen with dogs and cats as well.
True. Typically, it's more of a problem in cats. Most dogs, as puppies, are house trained. And typically, if there is a house soiling issue with a dog, it's going to be, number one, looking at, is the dog house trained? So especially in a younger dog, that's the first question that we need to ask. The second reason for house soiling in dogs that are house trained would be looking at the potential of separation anxiety. So kind of keeping track of when the dog does urinate or defecate inside the house. And typically it's going to be only when the owner's gone. No other problem if the owner's there. Dogs might also eliminate if they are afraid during storms. So those two anxiety causes for elimination inside the house, so separation anxiety and storm anxiety. In the older dog, it can be a sign of cognitive decline, where the almost like a doggy Alzheimer's, where you see this loss of house training and the dog starts to potty inside the house. In cats, it's more of a common issue. Typically, it's because if they're just urinating and or defecating outside the litter box, it's typically because they don't like the litter box. They don't like the toilet that they've been given. So one of the first things to look at is the size of the box. Size is really important when it comes to litter boxes. It should be about 1.5 times the length of the cat from the nose to the tail. So you're looking at probably a big plastic storage box instead of a commercial litter box, instead of which can be pretty small. And then also getting litter that the cat likes, and most cats like a good clumping, scoopable litter. So I would start there if you have a cat that's urinating or defecating outside the box.
Really important considerations. When you are talking to clients, is it important to have a kind of physical evaluation of the animal to maybe rule out any kind of ailments that might be contributing to some behaviors?
Absolutely. And that kind of, I'm glad you brought it up because it often goes without saying. Most of the clients that I see have been referred by primary veterinarians, or certainly have been seen already by their primary veterinarian. And that's the time where a good physical is done, a good physical exam, a good neurologic exam if necessary, any pertinent or necessary blood work is done, because we want to make sure that there's no contributing cause to the problem and or it's being addressed. Because even if the problem has been addressed medically, the behavior problem could still be there. For example, a cat urinating outside the box might have had a history of a urinary tract infection, which has now been treated and fine. But the cat has learned to urinate outside the box. It's learned to associate pain with the box so that they're now urinating somewhere else in the house. So that problem still needs to be addressed. The behavior problem needs to be addressed, even though the physical problem is long gone.
Now, I should say, you just remarked about an animal that has learned to associate the litter box with discomfort. And the association there, to me, as someone who has had pets before, I would find it quite daunting to even imagine how one might undo that association and therefore undo that behavior. It seems like quite a vexing problem.
So again, it's I do house calls, so I'm going to be in the person's home and see the layout and see the boxes that they've used. I'm going to start by probably recommending an entirely different looking litter box. I've recommended in some cases that they actually get a kiddie pool, K-I-D-D-Y, plastic swimming pool, fill that up with litter. It's about creativity. It's about thinking, quote unquote, outside the box when it comes to these kind of problems. And just kind of coming at it, again, in a problem-solving way, looking at things from the cat's perspective, while at the same time accommodating what the owner can and is willing to do.
And of course, the litter box is going to be situated somewhere in the home, and none of us wants to have a litter box like out in the middle of the living room. Where is a great place to put a litter box?
Typically, you want the litter box where the cat spends most of its time. If the cat spends most of its time on the second floor, you don't want the litter box in the basement or in the garage somewhere where the cat never goes. It should be in what we call the core area of where the cat spends, again, most of its time. You want it away from food and water, just like we don't want to be having our toilet in our kitchen. And you want it away from any potential noise, children, another dog. You don't want another dog to be bothering the cat while it's trying to eliminate, or another cat. So it needs to have free access to it. It needs to be able to come and go freely. And again, large enough so that it feels comfortable and can move around and do what it needs to do.
Okay, a critical consideration, other animals. You mentioned dogs, but certainly cats. that might be sharing a litter box. There can be issues between two cats sharing a litter box.
Correct. Typically, when that's a problem, and when I speak to about this topic with veterinarians, I tell them you're more likely to get presented with a elimination behavior problem where the client's going to say, my cat is not using the litter box to urinate or defecate. But what's really going on is two cats not getting along. And one of the biggest pieces of information to get from a client is, where is the accident? If the accident is right next to the box, so the cat is peeing or pooping right next to the box, it tells me and them that the cat can get to the box. So no problem. It can get there without interruption from a dog, from another cat. It can easily get to the place. It's not too far away. So that's not the issue. The issue right there is that it can get to the box, but it doesn't like the box. If the accident is way far away from where the litter box is, then I begin to think of other things. Why isn't the cat getting to that box? Is it too far away? Can it physically not make it? Is there something between where the cat spends most of its time and where that box is? Is there a child? Is there another dog? Is there a cat that's just kind of laying in the middle of the room, not allowing the cat that has a problem to get to the box? So we start thinking about it differently given the presentation of the problem.
A lot of what you're describing really does require that we try to not think like people, except with the exception of, like, of course, if you've ever been in a home and needed to use the bathroom and found yourself thinking, oh man, you know, the bathroom's all the way on another floor. That's kind of a drag. You know, you don't want to have to go really far to use the bathroom. Ideally, you want a bathroom where you are. That makes sense to me as a person. But many of the other things you're describing, it sounds to me like we need to not think like people, but try and do our best to think like the animal we are concerned about.
Exactly. And I think that goes a long way. Just kind of taking pause to remember that you are sharing your human life with either a feline life and or a canine life, and they, you know, navigate the world a little differently than we do. And so inappropriate is always a word that comes to mind. And it's just, these aren't inappropriate behaviors for the cat or the dog. It's just not something that we tolerate very well.
So the advice for a different kind of litter box and considering a better place for to put the litter box will probably, take care of many of the circumstances of inappropriate elimination that you've described. Now, with animals, of course, dogs, you mentioned some separation anxiety. And one can, try and, make the house a bit more friendly to a dog, put on some music or the radio when leaving the home. But what else can you do to help your dog not feel anxious when you leave and hopefully mitigate some of the elimination problems that might occur while you are away?
Well, separation anxiety is a pretty big topic, and it can be pretty complicated. One of the first things I want to put out there is many dogs that have separation anxiety, quote unquote, have been crated. And often they've been crated as a puppy because they were destructive. And so the diagnosis is given to a puppy of separation anxiety because it's been destructive. And so the dog is put into a crate. And it may tolerate the crate for a while. And as it ages, you may find that the dog no longer can be in the crate. And so you have a dog that has what I call crate anxiety. So it's in the crate and it's howling, barking. It may be drooling profusely. Obviously not a happy dog. And we still have this label from puppyhood that it has separation anxiety. So the owner is very leery about letting the dog out of the crate because they're worried that the dog is going to destroy the house. The vast majority of these kind of dogs truly have just crate anxiety. And getting them out of the crate and into the house where they're no longer confined can make that problem go away. Not in all dogs, but in very many, and in the vast majority of the dogs that I see that come to me for panic when they're crated.
Well, so what would the owner do in that circumstance? Just give it a try outside of the crate one day?
Give it a try. It's the one one situation when I'm with a client that I actually give out my home number, where I'll say, okay, I want you to take a drive to Publix, and I want you to let your dog out of the crate. Here's my number, and give me a call if there's a problem. And I haven't gotten called yet. So you want to make sure that the dog doesn't have crate anxiety. If the dog truly has a separation anxiety, there's basically two types of separation anxiety. One is departure anxiety, where the dog becomes very panicky when it sees the owner engage in a departure, picking up keys, putting on shoes, packing a bag, that kind of a thing, and actually walking out the door. For those dogs, they're absolutely fine if they just don't see the departure. If they're engaged in another room, chewing on a bone, or eating a food-filled puzzle toy or a Kong, they're fine. And so it's targeting that whole departure routine and changing it up for the dog. Other dogs truly have separation anxiety, where they cannot be alone, where they look around, they realize that they're alone, and then they start to panic. In either one of those cases, it's likely that they will need one, if not a combination of medications, to get them to the point where they can be relaxed enough to learn that they can be okay when they're alone and as their owner departs. And that's all done with behavioral and environmental modifications.
So there is a lot to discuss here. And something that I never really gave much consideration to until just a few years ago, but now when I've considered it a little bit more, makes a lot of sense. And it has to do with the way that our animals, our pets, kind of feel and their sources of comfort. And it was pointed out to me that cats, by and large, derive a sense of security and comfort from an environment with which they're familiar. And dogs often derive a sense of security from the people with whom they are familiar. Would you say that seems pretty true?
Yep, I've heard that said, and I would agree. I think there are some cats that get very attached to a human, but for the most part, I think that cats are comfortable in a place, and dogs are comfortable regardless of the place, as long as they're with their humans.
So what is it then that makes some dogs, and not others, especially troubled by the absence of their human friend?
It's individual variation. There's no the only thing we've been able to see as a potential cause would be, or a correlation anyway, are dogs that are rescue dogs. So dogs that are gotten from a humane society or shelter type situation. And there again, we don't know if it's the chicken or the egg. Do they have separation anxiety now because they've been in a shelter maybe a couple of times, or were they in the shelter first and foremost because they had separation anxiety and no one's talking? So we don't know. What we do know is that you can have this dogs from the same litter, where one will show departure separation anxiety and the other one will not. Just like two siblings where one has, you know, anxiety or panic and the other one doesn't. So it's always going to come down to nature nurture and that individual in a particular environment.
Yeah. Okay. So dogs that do have separation anxiety, this can present a real stressful situation to not just the animal, of course, but to the owners, because while you're gone, the dog might be getting into all sorts of mischief. And you come home and destructive activities have transpired. The garbage might be all over the floor. Your shoes might be torn up. And then I guess Terry Curtis gets a phone call.
Well, that what you just described does not sound like separation anxiety.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So most dogs who've read the book on separation anxiety are going to do their destruction at the place where the owner left.
Ah.
So you're going to see more doorway damage, door frame damage. Maybe the floor, they're trying to dig out the carpet where the owner left. A dog that's getting into trash may just be hungry. A dog that's going after your shoes may not have anything else to legally chew on. The biggest piece of information that we need to get, like you said, is happening when the owner's not there. So videotaping the dog is really important. Destructive behavior because they're looking for a legal thing to chew on looks a lot different than panic. And it's really important that owners do see that if the dog is panicked, that it is a panic or an anxiety disorder and needs to be treated as such. These dogs aren't spiteful. They're not mad that you left. They really are anxious and panicky.
Do dogs that have another pet in the house seem to do better with separation?
No. Some dogs, this is where it's all individual. Some dogs can be okay if there is another cat or dog or person in the household. Other dogs need that primary attachment figure, that one human being, and it doesn't matter who else is there. It could be a house full of people, but if that one attachment figure isn't there, that dog becomes panicky.
Do cats ever exhibit kinds of separation anxiety?
They do, but they do it a little differently. Some cats will start to over-groom themselves, so they start maybe over-licking their front paws or maybe their belly. Some cats will urine mark, so they'll start to spray in the house. Some cats urinate on the owner's bed, actual urination, not marking. And one has to make sure at that point that the litter box is being cleaned while the owner's away, the way that the owner would do it if they were there. So often it's a litter box hygiene problem, not a separation problem. But cats tend to do it more of a, again, it's kind of a self-mutilation or over-grooming and urine marking.
Let's shift gears a little bit here, Dr. Curtis, and talk about an issue that was brought up to me in advance of this episode. And it has to do with cats and their sort of persistent kind of desire to wake us up really early. What can someone do to kind of discourage that practice and maybe help the cat be a little bit more patient?
Well, you start by feeding the cat. There's a truth out there about feline behavior in the way that they eat. Cats eat about 15 small meals a day. So when we start to meal feed them two or three times a day, it really messes with their normal behavior of feeding. Cats are also what's called crepuscular, which means that they are most active at dawn and dusk, which is when they're going to do most of their hunting. So a dawn to a cat is going to be 3, 4, 5 in the morning, and that's when they're going to be most active, and that's when they're going to be looking for food. So I'm not a meal feeder of cats. I never advocate that cats be meal fed, regardless of how heavy they are. I think there's ways to get cats to eat a number of meals throughout the day in a legal way, whether it's setting up an automatic feeder that dispenses 12 meals throughout the day, whether it's getting food into little puzzle toys that the cats have to chase and get food out of, or leaving food out all the time in little bowls that they have to find around the house. But meal feeding cats can really cause a number of behavior problems. Waking up owners is just one of them.
So with the automatic feeders, have you seen these used successfully by folks?
I have.
And they, as folks who are listening to the show might imagine, these are kind of little feeding robots. And you put food in a hopper, right? And at a designated time that I think the human being can sort of set,
yep.
The machine will dispense a determined amount of food. And I have watched cats actually kind of... I don't know, from my perspective, sort of sadly stand next to the feeder waiting for it to dispense the food. But at least that cat wasn't pawing at a sleeping person's face.
Right. I'm a veterinarian first and foremost, so I don't willy-nilly make this recommendation that cats be free-fed or have food. But it's a really important part of their normal behavior. Cats that have restricted food have been shown to be aggressive to other cats in the household. I've seen cats that have been restricted in their food be aggressive to people, and once they're allowed to eat, they're no longer aggressive. The whole picture needs to be taken into account. Certainly, I'm not an advocate for giving cat diabetes or arthritis. So again, there's diets that these cats can be put on that may be a little more fiber, so they feel fuller, they don't need to eat as much. There's ways around it, and there's ways to come at it from a holistic approach so that everybody wins.
Before we take another break, let's briefly discuss something that can happen both to dogs and cats. From my experience, I've seen this before, and that is that an animal that is fed human food tends to, over time, I think, become a bit persistent when it sees a human being with food. And that can become a quite annoying behavior to the human being who is just trying to enjoy a meal, and then a dog or a cat is staring or maybe even trying to get at the food.
And remember, you're correct, but remember that the cats and dogs are learning what people are teaching them. They're coming into a home where if they learn that when mom and dad eat, I get some of that. If the game changes, they're not going to understand why. So it certainly makes sense to, especially a dog, the dog should be fed before the human, ideally in a way that's productive for the dog. So maybe in a food puzzle toy or in a slow bowl so that they're not just inhaling their meal in a minute, and or actually eat when the owner eats. So it's mealtime for everybody. And so the dog and the cat are going to learn what the meal deal is. But if they're taught that if they beg, they get something, that's what they're going to do because the human has taught them to do that.
Let's take a short break, Dr. Curtis. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about aggression. This can be something that can really make a relationship with an animal much more challenging. And we're going to take a short break and be back with more Animal Airwaves Live right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live on WUFTFM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. My guest today is Dr. Terry Curtis from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, and we're talking today about animal behavior. We're not taking any calls today. Apologize for that, but I am presenting Dr. Curtis with some emails that have come in over the last couple weeks. And before we move on to another topic, Dr. Curtis, I wanted to mention an email that came in. A person asked, what are some signs that an animal, in this listener's case in particular, a cat, is actually happy and content? Sort of clues that the owner has done a pretty good job.
What a great question. I have three cats, and I think they're really happy. So what do they look like? They're stretched out. They're loose. They're not hiding. They interact with you. They may talk to you. My cats talk to me. That would be my criteria. Interactive, part of the family, not hiding, not keeping to themselves. Cats are very social. And so a happy cat should be interacting with you.
Another listener asked about medication for calming cats. Do you often recommend medications for animals that might be exhibiting some sorts of signs of distress?
Yes, very much so.
Mm-hmm. What options are out there?
There's a number of them. Most of them are what the human class would be antidepressants. So fluoxetine is generic Prozac, and that's used quite a bit to calm both dogs and cats. And when I say calm, it is to decrease the possibility of reactivity. And what it does is allow the individual to learn better instead of being reactive to situations or triggers. Another class of drug is the benzodiazepines, and those are medications like Xanax and Valium. Those can be very useful in very specific context type situations, like if a dog is anxious during departures or anxious during storms, if cats are anxious for a short period of time when the owners are out of town, then those kind of short-term medications can be very useful. There's medications that are approved in dogs for use in storm phobia. There's a medication called Cilio. There's a medication approved by the FDA for dogs that have separation anxiety, and the medication is Clomacom. And then there's also a medication approved for dogs that have what I talked about earlier is doggy Alzheimer's or cognitive decline, and that medication is Anapril. So there's a number of medications out there, and whether it's your veterinarian or someone like me who's well-versed in its use, it can be very helpful.
This might be a good time, Dr. Curtis, to sort of remind listeners, though, that medications shouldn't just be certainly your human medication shouldn't just be given like willy-nilly to your pet. You should do this in consultation with a professional veterinarian.
Absolutely. It's one prong of a very multi-pronged approach to addressing the problem.
Another issue that I imagine you have to deal with frequently, unfortunately, would be the issue of dog aggression. And this can take many forms, right? Some dogs are aggressive around just other animals. Some dogs can even be aggressive with children or other humans. And this could be one of the worst case scenarios in a pet owner might ever encounter, right? An animal that is aggressive to a child. Something has to be done in those cases, right? I mean, that would be considered kind of a behavior emergency.
Aggression, dogs who have aggression towards people is the number one case that I see, and it's been the number one case for the 18 years that I've been doing this. Dogs are aggressive to people pretty much because they're afraid, and that doesn't change when it comes to children. Children can be very scary. Especially when they hit that toddler age, which is when they kind of toddle around and basically act like little Scud missiles. Very unpredictable in their walking pattern, very unpredictable in their speech pattern. And dogs just don't, for the most part, have any idea what they are. The children do a lot of grabbing. They do a lot of fast movements, which are all, which can be very threatening to the dog. So the first thing to remember, again, dogs are aggressive to people because they're afraid. And so we kind of have to dial it back and start again to look at things from the dog's perspective and come at the problem from that place.
A very important point. I mean, everyone who's ever been around a toddler knows that just suddenly, a child can grab at something or make a loud noise, and animals are no different. They are, to a child, just a fun object in the room that almost requires to be touched, right, or pulled at. And this, with some animals, will just sit there and be like, well, I guess this is my life now. This child is going to be poking me, and it's what it is. But other animals, you know, not unreasonably, from that animal's perspective, will take that as a sign of what? Aggression on the part of this person, right? And therefore, this is alarming, and the animal will kind of defend itself, so to speak. Even if we see the human child as harmless, the animal might be frightened.
Correct. And the thing to bring up here is and I'm because there's a lot of misinformation out there, there is no dominance. There's no dog being aggressive to a human being because it's trying to be dominant to the human being. Dominance is only a function of two individuals of the same species. So you can have dominance behaviors between two dogs, two cats, two humans, two birds, but not from a dog to a human being. So once that myth has been busted and we start to look at things, again, from the dog's perspective of what it's like to be in this human environment with a lot of uncertainty and a lot of inconsistency, it can be very scary for these dogs. And the other thing that you kind of brought up there that I want to point out, I'm actually more nervous when I see parents, and I see a lot of parents whose dogs have been aggressive to their children. I'm more concerned about the dog who hasn't shown the aggressive behavior, because the owner is now looking very cautiously at the dog who's growled at their child or has snapped at their child. But that, you know, that nice, sweet golden retriever that lets the kid do everything, that's the one I'm more worried about, because that dog could have a bad day and turns around and doesn't, you know, feel like taking it that day and snaps at the child, and everybody is just horrified. You know, how could this dog do this? Any dog can bite. If it has teeth in its head, it can bite. And so one has to be, especially the parents have to be the ones that monitor the situation and keep everybody safe, the child and the dog.
The refrain that I've read in many newspaper articles and even heard from dog owners is, well, my animal never did anything like this before. And this is often the sad tagline to many stories of children or even adults who have been seriously injured or even killed in a dog attack, right? What kinds of indications might human beings look for in an animal that suggest, hey, I'm the dog, I'm feeling frightened, I'm feeling troubled right now, just leave me alone?
And that's a great question. I think people, like I said, kind of bring in these pets that are in a totally different species that do have a way to communicate, and we never bother to look at how that's done, you know, how cats communicate, how dogs communicate. And yet, you know, they're in our house every day. First of all, I think with children especially, it's good to look at context. You know, where is the dog? But in general, looking at context, is the dog cornered? Is it in a crate? Is it up on furniture? Is it lying down? Those are all situations where the dog is in a very vulnerable place. It can't jump off a couch easy. It can't jump off a bed easy. It can't get out of a crate. It can't get up from lying down in its bed very fast. So getting the dog up on all 4 feet, getting it to be able to move around in a large open space is going to minimize the dog feeling uncomfortable. Signs of discomfort can be the dog's ears going back, the dog looking away with very wide eyes, kind of that whale-eyed where you see wide eyes with a lot of white around the eye, lip licking, yawning, tail down, panting. Those are all signs that the dog is not happy.
And of course, it should go without saying, but anyone with small children, always supervise the activity of the child with a pet, especially a pet that is unfamiliar to you. You know, it happens very quickly, these sorts of incidents. And the last thing you want to do is invite kind of trouble by not being attentive.
Absolutely. The child needs to be taught boundaries, especially if they live in a household where their dog is friendly, because you don't want that child to assume that every dog that it meets is going to be like that friendly dog that lives with them at home. They need to be cautious when approaching another dog, either not pet the dog at all or certainly ask permission to pet the dog. And the parents are the ones that need to be teaching their children this.
And are there solutions for dogs that have shown aggression to people or other animals that don't involve just getting rid of the dog?
Absolutely. It's what pays my rent.
What do you suggest to folks whose dogs have shown aggression in the past?
Again, it's a very multi-pronged approach. I'm somewhat hesitant to put it out there because it's so tailored to the individual. But there's a lot of things that can be done, whether it's medication to get the dog to be more relaxed, to probably the biggest thing that I do when I meet with a client whose dog is aggressive is to take that time and talk about how dogs learn, what it is that you're teaching them, what does the dog need to learn going forward, which is that the world isn't as scary as he thinks it is. And also spend a lot of time talking about communication, what the dog is saying, what you need to do when the dog says certain things, like, I'm feeling icky, I'm afraid, and give the owners the tools going forward to live with a dog who has these issues.
Well, we have very quickly gone through our allotted time here in this episode, Dr. Curtis. I want to say thank you so much for coming back and speaking to me. It's been quite a while, and I've been really eager to get you back, and I'm glad that you could take the time and visit with me today.
Well, thanks for having me.
I want to say thank you to those of you who listened to this program, and I want to invite you to tune in next week for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.